supervisor of elections, student loans, and sex and the church. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections, Susan Booker, was recently suspended by Governor Ron DeSantis. Booker was sharply criticized for the county's handling of the 2018 midterm elections and the recount. But she isn't leaving without a fight. Plus, a new report finds student loan debt in Florida is growing faster than anywhere in the country. Why are more students taking on debt in the Sunshine State? Then we meet Preston Allen, the January author for the Sundial Book Club, and we'll discuss his book, Jesus Boy. And finally, there's an arts festival this week in Broward County that's taking the energy of Art Basel and bringing it to Fort Lauderdale. We're going to talk with two of the artists that are creating work that's environmentally friendly. That's all coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, less than 3 months after Florida's hotly contested midterm elections and controversial recount, another supervisor of elections has been removed from office. Susan Booker, who led Palm Beach County's elections office since 2009, was suspended from her position by Governor Ron DeSantis on Friday. DeSantis cited gross missteps by the department during the election and the recount process that made national headlines. DeSantis replaced Booker with West Palm Beach attorney Wendy Link, a Republican. Steve Bosquet is following the story for the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times, and he joins us now from WFSU in Tallahassee. Steve, always a pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
So Governor DeSantis made this announcement on Friday. What was his justification for suspending Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections?
The governor relied on a very detailed three-page summary compiled by his new Secretary of State, Michael Ertel, who's himself a former supervisor of elections in Seminole County near Orlando. And it went on in great detail ended with a recommendation by Ertel that she be suspended from office, and that's what happened.
Now, going back to that November election and the recount, I mean, what were some of the primary issues, of how the county, of how Susan Booker handled the election and the recount?
Yes, some of the issues involved missing deadlines for reporting updated totals to the Department of State in Tallahassee, which just about every other county got right. She was criticized for not allowing news media representatives to observe the review of the manual recount, in the three statewide races that went to recounts. Susan Booker was criticized for not including the canvassing board in some of her deliberations. They should have been allowed to either observe or participate. I don't have the whole list in front of me, but it went on, and it's pretty damning. However, it's the governor's step is a suspension. She is suspended from office. In fact, I looked 5 minutes ago. Her name is still on the elections website.
One of the other stories, too, that we found that we remember is that that also got a lot of attention. It was about the polling place inside this gated community in Deerfield Beach, and some voters had complained that the security guards were preventing them from entering. I mean, could that sort of thing constitute negligence or incompetence that the governor is alleging?
I think it could. There's a judgment call here by DeSantis, and because DeSantis has suspended a superintendent of schools, and he suspended, of course, Sheriff Scott Israel in Broward County, he's being criticized for excessively using the power of suspending here. The thing is, in the statutes, there's no real cut and dried definition of what would constitute malfeasance or misfeasance. Susan Booker said in a rally on a Monday afternoon in West Palm Beach, she said that she's not going to give up. So I'm not ready to give up now. But
What kind of recourse does she have? What can she do?
Yes, well, she has one path to recourse, but it is fraught with all kinds of political problems. She has the legal right to demand a hearing in front of the Florida Senate, a trial, basically, is what it would be. And that would be very time-consuming, and I think I think senators would try to discourage her from doing that. Keep in mind that Susan Booker, before being elected to the supervisor of elections post, I go way, way back with Ms. Booker. She was a legislator elected in 2000, and she was I would describe her as a very tenacious, very hardworking, issue-oriented legislator, very liberal Democrat in a very conservative Republican environment. And she took no prisoners. She read bills. She read amendments. She debated. She challenged Republicans on the floor at every turn. And so while certainly that was her doing her job for her constituents, it did not endear her to a lot of people in Tallahassee. Even some Democrats were sort of put off by her level of intensity. And I think now she would be thrusting herself in an overtly partisan political environment to try to get her job back. The last supervisor of elections who tried this route was unsuccessful, and it was Miriam Oliphant in Broward County, who was suspended by former Governor Jeb Bush after a lot of irregularities in an election in Broward in 2002. So there isn't much of a success rate for supervisors at challenging these suspensions.
And you talk about Broward County, and we had supervisor of elections Brenda Snipes was suspended by Rick Scott, the former governor. She challenged that, and Governor DeSantis basically said he's going to accept her January resignation, and that's the end of that. But how do these two cases, how are they similar, how are they different?
Well, they're different in one very notable respect, I think, and that is that after the problems that happened in Broward County, Rick Scott, who was then the governor and, of course, who had a U.S. Senate seat hanging in the balance, Rick Scott made unfounded accusations against Brenda Snipes of things like voter fraud and stealing the election and things like this that were, beyond the pale. Snipes' performance was rife with difficulties, and I wrote a story about the conduct of election report her office did. She acknowledged not being prepared for this election in Broward County. But again, does it rise to the level that the governor should make a declaration that she's basically unfit to hold public office? Both Susan Booker and Snipes are duly elected by the people of their county in a countywide election. And so, the suspension, it used to be, I think in my earlier days of covering state government, it used to be that a person wouldn't be suspended from office unless they were charged with a crime. And we don't have that here. These are questions and valid questions, but these are questions about, the performance and the, whether there's dereliction of duty here.
Right. We're talking with Steve Bosquet. He's a columnist for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times covering state politics in Tallahassee. Again, as we mentioned, Governor Ron DeSantis recently suspending Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections Susan Booker. Bosquet is joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Steve, tell us about the replacement, West Palm Beach attorney Wendy Link.
Yes, Wendy Link is an attorney with very strong Republican political connections and a long record of civic activism in Palm Beach County. Groups like the Chamber of Commerce, she's on the State University System Governing Board. She was a Rick Scott appointee. She's a founding member of a law firm in West Palm Beach. And she has indicated as a condition of taking this appointment that she will not run for this office. This office would have been before the voters anyway in the 2020 general election. Supervisors of election are like sheriffs. They are constitutional officers. They're state officials. They are elected by voters every 4 years in partisan elections. And the next time this office is up is 2020. So this is a wide open election for supervisor in Palm Beach County on the same cycle where presumably President Trump is running for a second term.
And this is the second Republican replacement in a very Democratic county. Peter Antonacci was put in Broward to replace Brenda Snipes. Critics say these moves are political. But what issues do you see, with this move for the 2020 election?
Yeah, well, this is a valid point. Ron DeSantis could have appointed a Democrat. There are Democrats in Palm Beach County who would be kindly, disposed toward, following sort of, a Ron DeSantis agenda. But I have to say, and I've been all over this state with every supervisor of elections in this state, They are scrupulously nonpartisan people for the most part. It is a kind of job where you're expected to enforce the election laws and maximize people's voting opportunities. I was just at a hearing at the Capitol an hour ago where a supervisor of elections was discussing the need to fully implement the amendment that restores the right to vote to convicted felons in our state. So I guess I'm trying to say this, that there should be no opportunity for Wendy Link or Pete Antonacci to do their job in a way that favors one political party over another. That's wrong, regardless of whether the supervisor is a Democrat or a Republican.
And real quickly, because you bring up Amendment 4, and again, restoring rights to felons, voting rights to felons, but do we know anything about how either of those two are going to handle that? This is a question statewide, what to do next.
Right. They're grappling with a lot of issues there. For example, this morning, there was a long discussion about the fact that under the amendment that voters approved, a person convicted of murder does not get their rights restored automatically. But the question becomes, how is murder defined? Is it only first-degree murder? What about someone convicted of manslaughter? What about, that's the taking of another life as well, but it's not first-degree murder. What about a vehicular homicide case where someone is killed? And so they're grappling with there's going to have to be intervention by the legislature here, and it's got people concerned because the proponents of the amendment don't want anything to happen that sort of puts up barriers. After all, the biggest barrier of all was the old law that required people to wait 5 years to apply. So,
yeah.
And Broward and Palm Beach counties, by the way, all your big urban counties in the state are, for the most part, the counties where this amendment's going to have the most activity because you have large population centers there.
And that is an issue that we have been looking at and we'll continue to look at again the legislative session coming up in March. So this will be one of the hot topics discussed. Steve Bosquet, again, columnist for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times, joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Steve, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, all right. Thank you very much.
Well, still to come, Floridians are taking on more and more student loan debt. How much is too much? That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, if you're a parent with students in college or about to go to college, or maybe you're still paying off student loans, this news may not come as a surprise. A recent study from the credit agency Experian found that Floridians had the highest increase in student loan debt between 2015 and 2018. Student loan debt in Florida increased over that three-year period by 39%, up to nearly $90 billion. Florida has a number of statewide programs from college funding, including the Bright Future Scholarship, which could get another $25 million increase approved by the legislature this week. So why are Floridians continuing to take on more student debt than anywhere else? We're joined now by Mark Kantrowitz. He's a student loan expert behind the website savingforcollege.com. Mark, thanks for joining the program.
Thank you for having me.
So how much debt is the average graduate nationwide carrying around right now?
Well, the average bachelor degree recipient last year had just under $30,000 in student loan debt. And that's in slowing down compared to the growth rate in previous years because more students are hitting the federal loan limits. So the debt has been shifting from the students to the parents.
And how are the different generations handling that burden? I'm wondering which group is really hurting the most.
Well, people who retire with student loan debt are often hurting the most because they don't have new income to help them repay the debt. They just have assets and their Social Security to pay the debt. And if you default on a federal student loan, the federal government can offset up to 15% of your Social Security retirement benefits.
You know, I was looking at a recent study. This one was profiled on NPR's Marketplace, and they found that 1 in 10 millennials believe that they're going to die in debt. And this was from the Northwestern Mutual's 2018 Planning and Progress study. How do you determine for young people what is an acceptable amount of student loan debt to take on?
Well, if your total student loan debt at graduation is less than your annual starting salary, you should be able to repay your student loans in 10 years or less. It's only when your debt exceeds your annual income that you would struggle with a 10-year repayment plan, and you'd need an alternate repayment plan like extended repayment or income-driven repayment, which reduce the monthly payments by stretching out the term of the loan to as long as 25, 30 years.
So we look at Florida because, as we mentioned, Florida had the fastest growing rate of student loan debt. We have a successful statewide program here for students to go to college. So why is the amount of student debt growing so fast here?
Well, there are two sources of outstanding student loan debt. One is college graduates who are graduating with debt in the state. The other, though, is people who retire with their student loans. I mean, after all, Florida is a retirement destination. So people who have student loans are more likely to migrate to the state to retire, just like everybody else. And that contrasts with northern states that are cold and snowy, which aren't as much a retirement destination. So I wouldn't be surprised, and the Experian data does not differentiate between recent college graduates and people who graduated many years ago, but I wouldn't be surprised if part of the reason is an influx of people who are retiring with student loan debt.
So some of the federal aid packages and that are available for college students are either gone or they've taken a big hit. Pell Grants have taken a big hit with cuts. How much of a factor has that played in growing debt?
Well, the failure of government grants and appropriations, and that's both federal and state level, to keep pace with increases in college costs on a per student basis is a primary driver of increasing debt at graduation. It shifts the burden of paying for college from the government to the families. Family income has been flat since the late 1990s, and a slight uptick in the last year or two, but it's still essentially flat. That means families don't have more resources to pay for college. As a consequence, they react in one of two characteristic ways. One is to borrow more because it's the only form of financial aid, if you call it financial aid, that has any degree of elasticity. The other is they shift their enrollment from higher cost colleges to lower cost colleges. And that's not just from private nonprofit colleges to public colleges, it's also from 4-year colleges to 2-year colleges, from 2-year colleges to certificate programs, or even to no post-secondary education at all. And so as the debt increases, people struggle more to repay that debt, and they choose longer and longer repayment plans, which means that they are sustaining the amount of debt at higher levels because they're not making as much progress in paying down that debt.
We're talking with Mark Kantrowitz. He's a student loan expert behind the website savingforcollege.com. Again, a new Experian study found that Floridians had the highest increase in student loan debt from 2015 to 2018. He's joining us from his offices in Chicago. Mark, one of the questions people obviously have is, what's the reason behind the rise of co the increase of cost of college? Why is it going up?
Well, colleges have a different mix of expenses than people do. The Consumer Price Index, which is often referred to as the inflation rate, is a basket of goods and services that are used by people: food, clothing, housing, transportation, insurance, taxes. Whereas colleges are much more heavily weighted towards higher cost items, faculty and staff salary and benefits, facility costs, equipment costs, energy costs. And it's a heavily service weighted organization, industry. So I mean, there is a lot of expense in just providing the education. So the Higher Education Price Index, which measures the increase in college, the costs that colleges face, is higher than the Consumer Price Index. In addition, there's a multiplier effect from the awarding of need-based financial aid. There's something called the discount rate, which is typically measured for private colleges. which is the percentage of the sticker price that's given back to students in the form of grants from the college.
So,
and it's about 50%.
When a family is considering, you know, sending their kid to a school, you know, where should cost be in that consideration, and how should they look at it?
Well, the family should consider whether or not they can afford the college. And your least expensive option will usually be an in-state public college, where you're getting about the same quality education, sometimes even a better quality education, at a quarter to a third the price. And so even without as much need-based financial aid, your net price, the discounted sticker price, is going to be lower, and that means that you're going to be able to afford it. Too often, parents promise their children that you get in and we'll find the way to pay the bill to send you there. But when they look at the actual cost, they find that it is unaffordable, and that in order to pay that bill, they're going to have to take on an unreasonable amount of debt, both student debt and parent debt. And so part of the problem is parents need to learn to say no to their children. Maybe you can't afford a college that charges $70,000 a year, and instead you need to send your child to one that charges $25,000 a year. That's much more affordable, and you're not going to hamper your child's future by loading them up with too much student loan debt, and you're not going to sacrifice your retirement by borrowing too much parent debt as well.
Real briefly, I wanted to ask you about those folks, some of those retirees or a little older folks who've been out of school for a while, who are still carrying that debt. How much option do they have if they're still struggling and they may be carrying that for years and years? Because it's not debt that you can bankrupt out of.
Correct. So if you've retired with student loan debt, you have pretty much two options. One is if you have sufficient assets, you could pay off your debts in full. After all, I mean, you have no new income. The best solution is just to pay off all the debts, not just student loan debts, but auto loans, mortgages, as much as you can. But sometimes people don't have enough resources to pay off their debts, in which case you want to reduce those loan payments as low as possible so that the hit to your cash flow is as small as possible. And so for those borrowers, an income-driven repayment plan, which is available on federal student loans, may be the best option. It usually results in one of the lowest loan payments because it bases your monthly payment on your income, your discretionary income, as opposed to the amount you owe. And when you're retired, and if your only retirement income is Social Security, then you may have a very low, even a zero monthly payment under an income-driven repayment plan.
Yeah. Let me just finish on this real quickly. Has the partial government shutdown had any effect on federal financial aid applications or anything like that?
No, it's had no real effect. The Department of Education is still open. The main issues have been with data matches with other federal agencies that are shut down. So there's a citizenship match, there's a selective service system match, and those have had some issues. But talk to the college financial aid administrator at your college. They're familiar with the potential workarounds, which may be that you get the financial aid, but when the federal government shutdown ends, there will be a match at that point in time, and you may then, if you're not eligible for the loans, and you should know whether you're a U.S. citizen or permanent resident, then you might have to repay that student aid to the federal government.
Again, a new Experian study found Floridians had the highest increase in student loan debt between 2015 and 2018. We've been talking with Mark Kantrowitz, student loan expert, on the website savingforcollege.com. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And still to come, a conversation about the intersection of sex and the church. We're going to meet Sundial's January Book Club author, Preston Allen. That's coming up next.
Yo sé que tienes un nuevo amor.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we have been reading the book Jesus Boy from Preston Allen. It's a coming-of-age story about a teenage boy, Elwin Parker, a piano prodigy and a devout Christian who enters into a taboo relationship with an older woman in the church. Now, the book looks at the weaknesses and frailty of ordinary people, especially in those who try to live a pious life. Remember, you can join the Sundial Book Club on our Facebook group. Just ask to join. It's free. Preston Allen has written numerous other titles, and currently he's teaching at Miami-Dade College North Campus. Now, we talked to him last week, and we started by asking him, what exactly is this book, Jesus Boy?
It is star-crossed lovers, forbidden love, a coming-of-age story, if you will, and an exploration of faith, how faith can sometimes prevent us from being human. And at other times, it increases or enhances our humanity. You just have to grow up a little and realize that faith is out there not to separate, not to bury, but to unite and to reveal. Now, when you're writing, you're not trying to do anything. You're just trying to tell the story. Once I had Elwin and Sister Morrison, I just let her rip. But I think somewhere in the back of my mind, the spirit of the book was trying to do that.
And you finished it many years later. You were a grown man at that point.
Yeah.
Did the story change? What was the story you were trying to tell by the end?
Well, of course, I was young when I started it, so I had no idea how the relationship between people worked beyond the sexual level, right? And I just liked the idea of religion, you know, because basically that's what I knew at that time. Religion and Star Wars, if you will, Lord of the Rings. Almost everything I wrote was Lord of the Rings, my version of it, right? But this was dealing with real people. So I think I had to grow up to get an understanding of the relationship beyond the carnal, if you will. I never lost the carnal in the book, which enhanced it, I think, because I had that connection, that sexual, if you will, connection between the two characters that completely pulls them together. So what I did is I made sure that Elwin was tugged in another direction for his love of music and his love of God. Elwin is a genuine Christian.
Yeah, I want to know who Elwin Parker, the hero of the story, I suppose. Yeah. Who is he?
He's basically King David in the Bible. A man, very talented, very intelligent, who loves the Lord, but he's weak. Not weak, he's human. And I think that speaks to us all, because we have the things that we love, and they often separate us.
How much of him is you?
I would like to say since I was 16, well, of course it was me. Because when we're young, our first book is basically going to be autobiographical. By the time you're 20, you have at least one novel in you, and that's your story. Problem is, I didn't finish it until I was 42. But really, that's my first novel. Chronologically, it wasn't in terms of publication. So what we're having is me, a fantastical me, if you will, being explored by me. So it's kind of autobiographical, but not. I am not that plot, okay? But Elwin, his beliefs, his thoughts, his ideas on the world are kind of mine.
You grew up in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the story, the main setting mm-hmm. is this church, the church of our blessed Redeemer who walked upon the waters. Is this based on a real church or churches that you grew up in?
Well, several churches. The bulk of them, one church, the church that I grew up in. But of course, when I went to college, in order to feed myself, to get a few bucks on the side, I did what I know to do, which is play the piano. So I played for several churches, which broadened my understanding of what religion sort of is. Because when I was young, I only knew it from one point of view. But like I said, you go from church to church, and then you're going, okay, you're making connections. That's similar. We all have that in common. But this is what this particular religion does differently. this is what this one over here does differently. You can't wear this, but you can do that. And I mean, that's a complete sin in another church. You see what I'm saying? You want to look at what they have in common so that you can get that feel for religious authority. I've had people try to investigate what the religion was that I invented, and they have come to believe that it's mostly holiness mixed with Pentecostal, mixed with Baptist, Southern Baptist. And I'm like, wow, they just named all the churches that I played for.
So you basically were taking all these experiences.
Yeah.
This isn't a real church. You were taking these experiences to create this church environment.
There is one church that most of it's based on, but of course, it's broadened.
We're talking with author Preston Allen. His book is Jesus Boy. That is the January title for the Sundial Book Club. By the way, you can join the book club. Just find us on Facebook. Ask to join. It's free. We invite everybody. And we'd love to hear about what you're reading right now. Let's talk about Sister Morrison and her relationship with Elwin. And again, this is, you know, he's a young man. He's 16.
Yes.
At the beginning of the novel, she's in her 40s.
Mm-hmm. 42.
This relationship between them, why have this relationship between someone so much older than the other person?
Because that's the way it happens in church sometimes. You will feel something for someone that's quite natural, but inappropriate. And it sort of happens in our society where people who should not be together are drawn to each other. We got Romeo and Juliet, two houses. So we have two warring factions. Sister Morrison and Elwin are not warring because they go to the same church and they're in love. So it should be an appropriate relationship, right? Except you have the age thing. And later on, they have other things, other reasons that they should not be together.
I wanted to know about this relationship. One of the things, too, that jumped out for me was I kept thinking of, you know, Nabokov, you know, in his controversial
Vladimir
novel.
Nabokov,
Lolita. And so is it difficult to write about that kind of relationship because in society it's taboo, and in the church especially.
But the thing is, she's the female and he's the male. In our society, we think of him as troubled, but not a victim. Her brother brings up the idea of child sexual assault.
At one point, Sister Morrison's brother.
Her son.
Basically.
And her brother.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Calls her out for this relationship.
Right. And she has no answer except to say, well, I love him.
Is it a loving relationship or is it manipulation?
Again, we don't know. As the author, I would leave that question to the reader. I have my own ideas on it. It's a troubling question. Was it love or was it manipulation? As a teacher and a scholar, I would say manipulation. But as an author, I'm not so sure because we have to explore that.
One of the things that I struggled with is as I was reading this is I was trying to find the villain. And, you know, again, I kept seeing in people things that they would do that were upsetting. And yet at the same time, I understood, well, they're human. They made a mistake.
Yes.
But is there a villain?
People do villainous things, but there is no real villain except for the most holy woman in the book, the holiest of holy, the grandmother. But I humanize her, I think, by going back to her childhood so that you can see her when she was young and realize she is a victim of the world, of life, of the church, just like Elwin, just like the people that she, you know, is villainizing. Because we look at her and we say, oh, bad woman. Keeping secrets, dark secrets. But she kept the biggest secret, that Elwin, her grandson, was having an affair with an older woman. She kept that secret. So no matter how villainous you think her to be, she kept that one secret. And it was not for selfish reason. Oh, there's a somewhat selfish reason. But she genuinely loved her grandson.
So much conflict. People could be very cruel to each other in this book. Yeah. And yet there's a lot of humor.
Yeah.
And something you said to me I thought was interesting is like, don't try to write the humor. Just be real.
Just
the humor's
be real.
There.
Because we as humans are funny things, funny creatures. Yeah, the humor's there. Just tell it like it's supposed to be told, and people will be cracking up. They don't laugh, or you have to be a very talented comedian to get them to laugh if you're not telling the truth. Because it may not be hilarious, but it's funny, and oh, that's funny. There are some stories in my life that would crack you up, and then when you retell them, it's like, how do I make this funny? Just tell it the way it happened.
We're almost a decade since you wrote this book, since it was published. Do you look at it differently now? How do you view it?
I would like to say that technology would have enhanced the book if I could have said it in the current time. But it would not be true to the book. But 10 years later, every time I read it, I go...
And what do you mean by technology would change it? Are you talking about the language and what the characters
would
be doing?
Right, right. If they lived in this modern world, if you will. I could see Elwin and Sister Morrison texting each other, and things would be the same and yet not the same. Because, of course, technology doesn't change us. It just makes us do it faster and better and bigger.
What are you working on today?
I'm working on a book about sort of like an Edgar Allan Poe comes to life in one of my characters. It's going to be not a thriller, but like everything I write, kind of funny.
How far are you along on that?
I've written several drafts, so we'll see what happens.
President Allen, he is the author of Jesus Boy. That is the January title for the Sundial Book Club. Preston, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And you can learn more about him and the book at our Facebook group page, Sundial Book Club. If you're not a member, don't worry. Just ask to join. It's free. We welcome everybody. We'd love to know what you're reading right now. Well, still to come, Art Basel's done and gone, but there's more art to appreciate, and it's going on in Fort Lauderdale. We'll learn about the Fort Lauderdale Art and Design Week coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know, Miami gets a lot of the spotlight, right, for South Florida's art scene with events like Miami Art Week and Art Basel, but Broward County artists, they want to change that. This week is the Fort Lauderdale Art and Design Week, which runs all this week until the 27th. Satellite art fairs, artist talks, studio tours, open studio nights, after parties, and a signature event that's happening tomorrow, the Art Fair on the Water. It's one of the only art fairs that takes place on a boat in the water. Well, today we're going to talk to two local artists that you could see at the event, Harmony Jones and Dana Kleinman, joining me now in studio. Harmony, Dana, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
All right. And again, to find out more about the Fort Lauderdale Art and Design Week and to see photos of the artwork, you can go to social media, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Are shows like the one in Fort Lauderdale as important or more so than what we've seen here in Miami the last, you know, over the last couple of months with Art Basel? A lot of the attention, as I said, is here, but how is this one building itself up? It's still very young. I'd love to know from both of you what you think about that. Harmony, Dana.
Okay.
Oh, right, Harmony, go ahead.
Dana.
Oh, Dana, sorry, I'm going back and forth. Dana, go right ahead.
I think that Miami has always kind of had the focus on them for the art scene in South Florida, and Broward is really trying to make a difference, and I think that this art fair is unlike any of the art fairs that go on around the country. Instead of being in a tent or being in a convention center, you are going by boat, by water taxi, which is also a really cool experience just to go on the water taxi. And then you are winding up at multi-million dollar houses that are for sale, and you're seeing art staged in these homes. So it's like an open house mixed with an art, mixed with, and then there's experiences too.
So the idea is to see the art in a different way, see it where it would be, which is on a wall in your home.
To see it in a dreamlike home.
Okay, well that...
Yes. To see it as your fantasy home. Yes.
I see. And yeah, Harmony, what do you think? What's different about this art festival? And, you know, but is it trying to be something more? Is it trying to be like whatever Miami's doing?
I think it's exciting. It's grown. It's in its third year. It's its own. I really believe that.
What do you think of what's happening in Broward County when you talk about the art scene? And does it matter if more attention is... Miami's always going to get a lot of attention anyway, but does it matter that it does? Does it matter that Miami's getting so much attention? Or does Fort Lauderdale, you know, does it want to step up and say, wait a second, we're just as good. We're just as good. Why are you paying all that attention to them?
Well, I do think we're just as good because we are growing. It's super exciting. I can't wait. Like, I've had two other friends in the show last year.
Yeah.
And they had nothing but great things to say about it.
All right. Let's talk about your work. Harmony, I'm going to start with you. And by the way, one of the other things I thought is interesting is that both of you, in the work that you do, is that, you know, you think about the environmental impact that your art will have, not just on buyers, but also the way you create art. I remember from art school, art is such a wasteful thing. I can't say how much paper I went through, or how much just equipment and stuff that I threw away. And I wasn't even thinking about it back then. But Harmony, let me start with you. How do you bring that into your artwork? You try to repurpose material.
Absolutely. And Dana as well.
Yeah. How do you do it?
I find things, flea markets, garage sales, different, but a lot of times walking on the beach, I can find a ton of stuff.
What are you looking for?
I find beach stones. I find driftwood. I find barnacles and different shells.
Do you purposely look for stuff, or you're just like, oh, here's something, maybe I can turn that into art?
I do both.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I have the times that I do that during the week that I go out and purposefully, you know, I'm looking for specifics.
What's the strangest thing that you've ever taken and like this, maybe this could, I can turn this into a piece. What is it? Go ahead.
Probably different bones from animals, fish.
Okay.
Lobster, different fish. Yeah.
Okay.
Fun things.
What you have a piece that you're going to be showing at the fair, at this art fair festival, the flower mandala.
Yes, it's a mandala.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the flower of life. So that's like a geometric shape. If you were to look that up, it is based.
These are like what the Buddhist priests create, the sand mandalas.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's yours made out of?
It's made out of hydra stone. So hydra stone is an interesting material. If plaster and cement had a baby, that's what hydra stone would be. It's super hard material, and it can be tinted in any kind of color. But it's also got moss that's encapsulated this mandala with a crescent at the bottom that's made out of walnut.
And we have, by the way, we found some pictures as well that are online.
Good.
So people can see what that looks like. If you've ever seen a sand mandala, they are really beautiful. This is fascinating as well. Dana, you as well, you know, the environmental impact of art is important to you. By the way, you and your sister work together.
That's correct.
As a duo.
Yes.
That, first of all, I've got to say, I applaud that. I don't know if my brother and I could work together without wanting to get after each other. Your work is also fascinating. It's two-dimensional, three-dimensional, as well as sculptures, and you work a lot with metal.
Mm-hmm. My sister is the metal artist, and I'm the painter. So we each kind of still stick to our own areas of expertise. However, we now combine them together. And the work, for us, because our work needs to be cleaner in the aesthetic, it's a little more difficult to not be wasteful, because you would think we would need nice, clean, new metal, and as well as top-notch painting. But we do our best to source at least partially recycled metal, partially recycled aluminum. And then our latest series is using repurposed industrial piping that we then fill with paintings. So basically, you think about pipes that are used for water lines, oil pipelines. We're cutting them up. We're taking scrap and we're cutting them up. We're shining them up, making them pretty and new looking. And then we're filling them with painting. And recently, I've also transferred away from any kind of chemicals in the paints. I'm trying to use more natural pigments, water-based materials, so that there is less of an environmental impact.
Again, I'm talking with Harmony Jones and Dana Kleinman, both artists, local artists here. They follow the themes of connection, balance, nature, and environment. And it's not just in their work, but it's the fact that they are trying to produce work that is environmentally friendly. And you're going to be able to see them at the Fort Lauderdale Art and Design Week. Again, it runs through the 27th. I wanted to ask about, and you know, taking it to the next level, is what the message is in the work. So you're trying to create work and you're thinking about the environmental impact of the materials that you used, as you both described, your recycling stuff, so that way nothing does go to waste. But then what's the message? What is it you're trying to get across, like any artist? Or is it, are you leaving it up to us? Harmony, do you just want us to figure out what you're saying?
I hope that I bring people closer to nature in their own way. I hope that they can connect, you know, make that connection for themselves and see that whatever part of them hooks in to nature, they can think about that, and that can be reflecting. Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, you're not originally from Florida.
No, originally from Eugene, Oregon.
Okay. But you know what? You came here and this setting inspired you.
Oh, absolutely.
What is it?
Well,
I know we're paradise, but
I've been a child of the water, you know, since I was little. I learned how to water ski when I was 5 years old. So the water is here, and that light just emulates the whole place, especially in Miami as well as Fort Lauderdale. We have all those great little waterways.
Did you know, I mean, was it when you moved here, you knew right away that it inspired you in your work, or is
absolutely
that something that grew over time?
No, absolutely. It grew. Well, it's done both. Mm-hmm. But when I saw the way that the light reflects and the water changes things so much, that it's just completely different than on the west coast of the country.
Dana, yeah, what is it about here in Florida that inspires your work specific? And again, I think about the way you work with metal and color, and you bring that, it's that same vibrancy that we have when you think of, even when you step outside and you look, it's just bright and colorful all over everywhere. But I don't know, what is it about living here?
I'm going to go with water as well.
It's the water.
But also definitely the bright colors here and the sun. I would tell you that our work has changed drastically in color since I moved here. My sister had been in South Florida working, doing the metal work for the past 15 years, and I only recently moved here, and my color palette changed dramatically after moving here. A lot brighter, a lot of blues, a lot of water.
Yeah. How is the issue, you know, think about the big issue here, obviously, is sea level rise.
Mm-hmm.
How is that impacting your work right now?
Well, I can say that the series that we've done with repurposed pipe, industrial pipe, thinking about pipelines, first came after Hurricane Irma, which happened right after I moved here. So I'm in Hollywood, Florida, and we went through several periods with the boil water alerts, and just making you think of the infrastructure of bringing clean water to the people, and then what's going to happen when there's sea level rise. So I think that as much as in my work, I like to say that I talk about the solution and not the problem, and I want to do things that give a positive message and an uplifting message, water issue definitely comes into it.
Yeah, Harmony, for you, real quickly, the same thing. How are you approaching that issue of sea level rise and the fact that this may all be gone by the end of our lives?
I know. It's tough. But I do have a few pieces actually that are titled and look at this issue specifically. One of them is called Rise, and it has some scrap metal as well as plywood and tons of blues with the sky and the water.
Work, again, that you could see and check out throughout the week, because, again, it is Fort Lauderdale Art and Design Week. Harmony Jones, Dana Kleiman, two local artists that you can check out. By the way, go to our Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial so you can see some of their work. Harmony, Dana, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you.
We're excited.
Keep creating great art. And that is our program for this Tuesday, January 22nd. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.